Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with George Kotkin, Emeritus Professor of History at California Polytech State University. His book, Feast of Excess, A Cultural History of the New Sensibility, published by Oxford University Press, is the topic of this show. Kotkin has given us cultural criticism through a set of provocative portraits of creative Americans at mid-century who defied convention, pushed the boundaries of aesthetics, and forged a new sensibility of personal liberation. From John Cage, who in 1952 explored the musical possibilities of silence in the composition 433, to Chris Burden's 1974 performance piece, Transfixed, nailing him to a Volkswagen. Both defied the standing categories of art and aesthetics. Two dozen dramatic vignettes demonstrate the excess of violence, sex, and madness that blur the boundaries between art, artist, and audience. Cultural creatives such as Marlon Brando, Lenny Bruce, Andy Warhol, and Anne Sexton populate his pages. The fascination with excess cut across diverse expressions, taking art and audiences into uncharted territories of the imagination. The distinction between high and low art erased. Kotkin argues that this avant-garde, pushing the limits with a mania for the new and unfettered subjectivity, constitutes American culture today. Yet for all its transgressions, the new sensibility was politically impotent, and its excesses fed the explosive growth of capitalism, consumerism, and the golden age of advertising. The new sensibility became stale, expected, and commodified. With a weakened power to shock, it has become our culture, our sensibility, yet still offering the possibility of something passionate and new on the boundary between liberation and limits. Here is my conversation with George Kotkin.
Now let me introduce you to the author, George Kotkin. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a thrill to be here. I love what you do with your show.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book is a provocative piece of cultural criticism. But before we get into the book, and you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Feast of Excess.
Okay, well, my background is I'm from New York City, the Bronx, and Brooklyn, and I graduated Brooklyn College, and then I went to Ohio State for my PhD, and I've always been interested in intellectual history, though my dissertation was on working-class intellectuals and evolutionary thought. And then in 1979, I went to a conference seminar called the Newtonian and Darwinian Revolutions in American Thought. That's a mouthful. But Bruce Kuklick was one of the people there, David Hollinger, Jim Hoops, and others. And it was at that point that I became interested in the philosopher William James. And then I decided to spend my time with James and continue in intellectual history. And I taught at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo for about 33 years until I retired 2 years ago.
So why Feast of Excess? Why this book?
Well, you asked how I got to this point, and I'm afraid, like all of my book projects, it was kind of circuitous and complicated, a process. I had been working on, maybe 12 years ago, I was interested in writing a book that would look at five or six figures, Andy Warhol, Susan Sontag, Anne Sexton, James Baldwin, Bob Dylan, and try to bring them together in a coherent narrative. Well, I was working on that. Maybe I had 100 pages written. And then my wife's family wanted to go on an Alaskan cruise. And so I said, fine. And I figured out, what would I read? Well, I would reread Moby Dick. So as I was reading Moby Dick on this Alaskan cruise, I decided that I wanted to write a book about Moby Dick. So a project on the 60s was thrown overboard, and I wrote the book on Moby Dick. Once I had finished that book, I thought I would return to a book about the 60s. But then I thought, well, maybe now's the time to write a novel. And so I started working on a novel about Friedrich Nietzsche and William James. And as I was working on that, I then moved on, said, it's not right now, so I'll go back to the 60s project. And then it was just a question of finding the right form to do it. And I think I finally did.
Well, you know, your book covers 1952 to 1974, but it reads, though, like it's today. It doesn't read like you're reading a piece of history, which is why it hit me that this is a piece of historical criticism at its finest. You're using the past really to make commentary about the present. And in the introduction right away, I noticed he's repeating himself a lot. And I was thinking, this must be bad editing. And then I realized, no, it's on purpose. He's doing this on purpose because that idea of repeating was something that you carry throughout the book. And you make that point in a kind of a offhanded way in the introduction. So how do you see this work? Am I correct? Is this a piece of cultural criticism?
I think all of my work is intended to be more than history. My interest in history is not intense. I use history to try and respond to questions that I have, concerns that I have, and that I hope are shared by others. So this book, in a sense, is no different from all the other books that I've written. And I do want to make it lively in terms of responding to controversies and issues that are present today. And to try, when I was reading these figures, I wanted to capture them at the moment of when they came up with a concept for a project, when they were writing, or when their project was done and being received. So I was trying in that sense to mimic to a degree what I was writing about.
Well, the subtitle of your book is A Cultural History of the New Sensibility. What is the new sensibility?
Well, the new sensibility was a term that Susan Sontag coined in 64, 65. And just right after she did, Tom Wolfe, the man in the white suit, also was using that term, although they were using it quite differently. What Sontag saw in American culture in the mid-60s was a shift away from the traditional New York intellectuals who had emphasized depth, close reading, the notion that a Marxian or Freudian interpretation, you know, could get into the depths of meaning and bring something out. And she thought that was terribly mechanical and boring. What she wanted were works that were exciting, even if only on the surface level. So when she saw a film like Flaming Creatures by Jack Smith that was made in 1963 and that was quite controversial, where you see a bunch of figures, floating around on screen. The film work is amateurish. You can't quite tell what's happening. I don't know what's happening for sure, but there seems to be an orgy at one point. Some people are naked. There seems to be homosexual sex. She thought this was just the greatest thing since ice cream. And what she liked was how it was challenging boundaries, how it had a certain kind of surface beauty. So she was trying to take us away from particular concerns and to expand the cultural horizon. So she would say, I also wanted to break down the distinctions between high and low culture, to blur boundaries, to not be so stuck in the mud intellectually that you couldn't enjoy a Supremes song. And so she said, I love to dance to the Supremes. Now, Sontag did not say that she thought the Supremes were the equal of Dostoevsky in terms of depth, but she said there's no reason why we have to limit ourselves. The culture is pluralistic. At the same moment, you've got Tom Wolfe, who's writing, you know, this prose that is just jumping off the page, that's redundant with exclamation points, with dashes, with capital letters. And what he's looking at is popular culture as well, but a different popular culture. He's seeing, you know, American creativity and stock car racing. You know, Jimmy Johnson is a hero to him. He sees it in the people who are doing drawings on cars. And of course, even in Las Vegas, the nightmare for most architects and intellectuals is something that Tom Wolfe celebrates for its freedom, for its signage, for its, you know, craziness.
What is different about this new sensibility, as you describe, with what we think of as being, you know, the counterculture?
Well, that's a good question. at first, I didn't think of it as being that different. You know, when you look at Sontag and you look at Wolf, they're writing at exactly the moment that the counterculture is becoming central. And of course, the Beatles arrive, wasn't it, in 64 or something? So you can see sometimes that the Beatles are seen as shifting American culture. But as I thought about this, I realized with some others, mostly writing about politics, though Morris Dickstein also writes about culture, that the 60s really begin in the 50s. And I was noticing that many of the people that were considered to be gurus of sorts for those who were 60s radicals begin in the 1950s. And as I started to widen my net, I started to realize that, gee, well before the Beatles were even playing in Germany, you had people like John Cage doing experimental things. You had the Living Theater. You had American rock and roll. You had all of these expressions in culture that were essentially part of the new sensibility. And I thought then that the very term new sensibility was a good way to refer to something that's sometimes now known as the long 60s. But rather than from like 57, I thought John Cage is always a good place to begin.
Now, your subjects are all expressing what you talk about, which is an excess in your art, an excess of violence, sex, drugs, pushing the limits of respectability and risk taking. But it wasn't just in their art. It was their life. It was like they were doing these things in real life. They weren't just doing it, you know, in their art form.
Yes.
And so let's talk about some of these people that you have in your book. You've got, I think, maybe 27 of them or more.
Could be.
Okay. So let's talk about John Cage, because I think he is an important figure, because what he did so early was so provocative, and he really blurred the lines between the art, the artist, and the audience.
Yes. Cage is fascinating, but before I talk about Cage, you know, I don't want to give the impression, sometimes overly romanticized, that one has to live a life of excess in order to create art that is excessive. You know, that famous line from Flaubert, where be bourgeois and orderly in your regular life so that you may be wild and creative in your art. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And of course, John Cage is a man who was not excessive in his personal life generally. You know what I mean? He was pretty steady, working all the time. But now for John Cage, Cage is a revolutionary figure. I'd read a book by Kyle Gann about Cage and got interested in him, and then went to a show at MoMA on John Cage and his influence. And it was at that moment that I thought Cage is the person who in many ways starts with. You know, you can draw a line from Cage to Lou Reed, perhaps even to David Bowie. And in 1952, in two very different ways, Cage was playing with excess, minimalist and maximalist. And that's another thing that the book is about, is how I think you can talk about excess in a minimal way and a maximal way. A minimal way, for example, would be John Cage's famous piece for piano, 433, which debuted at Woodstock. And what it basically was a pianist, David Tudor, comes to the piano, you know, sets up the music, sits down and follows the music, but basically strikes nary a key. It's 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Now, that is as minimalist as you can get. But of course, Cage, who's always cagey and witty, it was about was the fact that there is no such thing as silence, that the audience would be talking with one another, that they would feeling uncomfortable, that they could hear the wind whistling, that they could hear the whatever was going on. And that's what the piece was about, because Cage always wanted you to open up your ears to things that you were unaccustomed to.
He was forcing them in that piece to experience their own subjectivity. Which a lot of this idea of subjectivity runs through a lot of these people, that it was all about the subjectivity of the artist and expressing himself, and he was forcing the audience to do that.
Right. So it's a two-way street. It's the subjectivity of the artist, but also for many in the New Sensibility, it was about involving the audience in the piece of work so that in that sense, they are, of course, interpreting the work through their own manner. And that was one of the things that I think is central to the New Sensibility. And then, of course, at the end, you know, also in 1952, John Cage stages the first Happening. And that's at Black Mountain College. And, you know, they've got, so he's on a ladder reading poetry. Rauschenberg's got paintings that people are looking at. Other people are reading other things. Charles Olson is there. You've got people, you know, doing this kind of dance around. And so it's the absolute maximum of chaos that's going on. And, you know, that's what he loved. I remember, I think it was for John Cage's 75th birthday. He had a birthday party in a park in Los Angeles, and my wife and I went there. And what he had was the park was surrounded on the perimeter by different booths, and each booth had people doing different kinds of music. And you would work your way around the park until you came back to the starting point where John Cage was serving birthday cake for his birthday. But what happened was, wherever you were in the park, you heard quite different things. So in that sense, while everybody was playing at the same time, your position was central to how you experienced the art. And that was something that was important to Cage. It was important to the living theater. It was important to certain rock stars. Yeah, that whole performative aspect in which the lines between audience and performer breakdown is part of the New Sensibility, and of course something that is with us today.
Now, you've got a lot of people in your book, and they're musicians, they're novelists, they're poets, they're all kinds of people that are doing very creative, edgy things. And instead of me picking out some of the ones that stood out for me, I want you who are some of your favorites in this book, and and why? They might be at a point of where there's a shift, or they might be bringing something fresh that others hadn't.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I guess I turn to Andy Warhol. Fascinates me. I don't pretend to understand him, but the number of things that he's doing over a period of time in so many different ways and willing to challenge propriety, not just with his films, you know, that deal with sexual issues, but, you know, like there's this one film that he makes where he goes up, I think it was the Time Life building. He goes up to the 40th floor at about 8 o'clock at night, and he starts filming the Empire State Building across the street. And the camera's on a tripod and nothing happens. Occasionally, of course, you see something very subtle like clouds are moving or a plane may go by. But that becomes his film Empire. And I remember one wag or critic said something about, oh, yeah, it's an 8-hour hard-on since it was dealing with a phallic structure of immense proportions. Then you get Warhol even doing political art with his Death and Disaster series. He does a piece of art where he takes a photograph of the electric chair at Sing Sing, the one that apparently was used for the Rosenbergs, and then he colors it and reproduces it. So Warhol is somebody that I find pretty amazing. I think Deanne Arbus is amazing in terms of the way she chooses subjects that we would normally ignore and presents them, depending again upon the viewer, when she had her big retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, I think it was, or maybe it was the Metropolitan, whatever. Some people would spit on the photographs because they found them obscene. They found them disgusting. Other people saw her as having a close relationship to her subjects, presenting them in a humane fashion.
She was photographing what people would call freaks.
Yes. And she loved freaks and she identified with them. And she was, you know, very seductive in her way. She was very small and she was soft spoken, and generally she was, and she would become friends with them. And some of these people, like the Jewish giant in the Bronx, she, you know, was in touch with him for 12 years. I think she calls him the Mexican midget. That was someone that she knew. And sometimes, you know, in some of the photographs, she was photographing swingers. And usually one of the assumptions of photojournalism and of journalism in general, and even history, is that one has a certain distance from one's subject. So you see her taking a picture of these two swingers, and then suddenly you see one of the swingers taking a picture of her laying naked on this guy's knee. So she was becoming part of the art itself. So that those lines that you talked, you know, we were talking about between types of art and the artist and the subject really do break down. And coming to familiarity with Eric Burdon, who was the lead singer of the Animals, but with coming to terms with Chris Burdon, I found him fascinating for his willingness to refuse very particular lines of what constitutive art, of performance, of the role of the body in performance, and of the role of the audience in performance. I mean, many people may not know about Chris Burdon. He died just last year. But beginning in the early 70s, he started to do art where his body was the site for the art. In one piece, he had himself locked into the middle locker of three of a high school college locker. And I think he was there for 3 or 4 days. And people could walk by and talk to him. But on top of him, he had water so he could drink some water. And below him, he could basically relieve himself. And that was the piece, was just to exist in a locker for a number of days. In another piece from 1971, and perhaps his most controversial, he invited a number of friends to this place, and the invitation read, "At such and such a time, I will be shot. You're invited." And people came, and there was someone there with a .22 caliber rifle, and he was shot. Now, one could say that this is, of course, performance art. This is pushing the limits. As John Cage's mother said to him after she had heard his composition 433, "John, don't you think you've gone too far this time?" Well, I imagine that Chris Burdon's mother and father would have said, "Don't you think you've gone too far this time?" Well, he only wanted to be grazed in the arm, but, you know, it's not an exact science shooting someone. But what happened was that in some ways, as Maggie Nelson has pointed out, this piece is also about the role of the audience. How could you, as a friend of the artist, allow your friend to be shot in the arm or maybe somewhere else? In another piece that he did in Chicago in the same period, he laid down on this gallery floor. People were there, and hour after hour passed. Roger Ebert, who was then a young reporter in Chicago, was supposed to cover it. After about 5 hours, he said, "I'm going to the bar. Call me if anything happens." Hours, day passes. He hasn't moved from the floor. Finally, after a couple of days, I think, someone gets a glass of water and walks onto the stage and puts it next to this prone body of Chris Burdon. Burdon gets up, takes a drink of water, walks toward, I think it was a clock that was nearby that was recording the time, takes a hammer, breaks the clock, and walks off. So in that sense, it was about the audience's willingness to allow this person to punish himself and how long they would allow it. That's going far.
So let's talk about, you don't spend a lot of time on this, but it's there, the critics, you know, who've been critiquing high literature and art and music, and all of a sudden they've got all this on their hands. How did the critics respond to all this?
Generally with less than enthusiasm. Although, you know, you do find that one time somebody had left a whole bunch of issues of the old Partisan Review on a desk at Cal Poly for someone to take away. And so, of course, I couldn't resist that. And as I was going through them, I was surprised at how much interest they were showing in this artwork. Now, they weren't always enthusiastic about it, but for example, the Partisan Review at one point had an excerpt from Philip Roth's Portnoy's complaint about him, shall we say, spending time with himself. And that was not the kind of thing that their traditional partisan review would necessarily be highlighting. So you do see interest, but for much of the critics who were traditionalists, it was difficult. But some try to move with the times. At first, Leslie Fiedler calls them the New Mutants and is not very enthusiastic. And then before you know it, he's smoking dope and, you know, becoming a celebrant of it. So, but of course, then on the other hand, someone like Sontag, who is seen as celebrating it, starts to break away as the cultural revolution continues in non-political ways. She grows frustrated and she becomes more politically engaged.
Yeah, this is okay. This is a good segue to a concern I have. Your subjects are very much about subjectivity, self-expression. There doesn't seem to be a lot in this work, self-reflection, or an expression of any sort of social virtues, of social concern. Are they really just individualistic or individualism taken to an extreme excess? Or is there political? Is there political? There is some, but it seems like overall there's not a lot of concern with structures of power, except just to make fun of them, but not of change.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was in this period that the phrase "the personal is the political" was coined, and I think for many of these people, the personal was the political. Though I don't know that necessarily it meant that one could not be engaged in a movement. I mean, you think about Ginsburg, who was in many ways a great exemplar of the New Sensibility, but who was politically engaged all the time. Mailer, of course, writes about the March on Washington, about the various conventions. Gore Vidal is politically active. But I think you're right that by and of course, Amiri Baraka is very active in the Black Arts Movement and the Black Liberation Movement. But I think that for many of these individuals, political action is confined to going to demonstrations, signing petitions and things like that. Most of them are people of the left, as you would imagine. But beyond that, I don't think most of them had a deep understanding of structures of power and things like that. But then again, that was oftentimes the critique of much of the student movement of the 1960s. I mean, I think in SDS you had people of that analysis, but the people in SDS oftentimes looked askance at the more cultural revolutionaries.
Right, because there seems to be an emphasis on the personal liberation.
Mm-hmm. Although personal liberation and political liberation were oftentimes seen as part of the same, you know, two sides of the same coin. Yeah.
Okay. Now, they express a lot of desire, personal desire, power, personal power, asserting their personal will on the world through art, you know, by changing things and adapting things, which I think you point this out, but I saw that as being sort of coming into what you talk about as being the engines of capitalism, desire and power.
Mm-hmm.
That is what capitalism sort of grabs onto in order to expand, you know, consumer desire.
Yes.
Power. So how do you see their work playing into this massive growth of consumer society and capitalism and economic power?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. A good friend of mine who's a labor and economic historian loved the book Nelson Lichtenstein, but as he told me yesterday, you don't deal enough with capitalism. And I was conscious of that. And I guess my response is as follows, however inadequate it will no doubt be. You know, Fitzgerald in the 1920s stated what seems to me the obvious, that culture follows money. And obviously, much of this is a function of the rise of consumerism. It's the rise of money culture, and all of this helps the artist. And yes, however, capitalism goes up and down in terms of its success. You know, there are minor depressions, there are minor setbacks, and you don't necessarily see the new sensibility, halting in its footsteps. I think what I wanted to emphasize that there, and this is not in a Clement Greenberg sense of way, in that art is only artists responding to other artists, but I think once you let loose these gates in the early 50s, when you do have this expanding capitalist economy, you do have this sense that these artists are responding to this freedom that seems to be. Now, sometimes this freedom can be co-opted and used, as in the Cultural Cold War. I don't reject that for a second. But I don't think when John Cage is doing his work, or when Robert Rauschenberg is erasing the de Kooning, that the state of capitalism is anywhere on their mind other than, I suppose, as a protest, you know?
No, I mean, I agree with you on that. I don't think it is a sort of a conscious thing, but consumer capitalism, markets, is driven by instigating in people desire and power. That's how you sell products to people.
Right.
This product will, you know, fulfills a desire and it gives you power. And this is sort of the message that this is what they're working with. This is the raw material that these artists are working with, desire and power. That's why I'm asking that question.
Yeah. And I suppose it's also, the question is, how is that desire and power related to liberation? Now, that may not be, it could be a false liberation, because, of course, what freedom do we have in our ability to choose between 17 different brands of soap or laundry powder? But I mean, I think, you know, Tom Frank wrote that book years ago in which he talked about, as I recall, that advertisers, rather than, you know, they came up, they were fascinated by the cultural revolution that was occurring, not simply because they thought it could sell products, because it was going to liberate them from all these tired formulas that they were expected to use to sell products. So I think that, yes, of course, all of this is related to the power of the individual to enter liberation, which has, of course, a dual aspect. On the one hand, capitalism's power is to convert, to divert, and to, you know, take over. I think that's a given. I mean, even, you know, Huey Newton and all the radicals, in a sense, can become, Che Guevara becomes a consumer symbol. So I think the power of capitalism doesn't need to be stated. I think it's obvious, but these individuals were working within those confines, but oftentimes you're trying to undermine it. Like, performance art is, by definition, or at least generally, something that is designed to break away from consumerism and art markets.
So this is exactly, there's the irony there, that these mm-hmm. artists are trying to break away, but the art is so trapped by the raw materials that they have to work with, that uh-huh. they really can't escape. There's no escape from the culture.
Well, I suppose by definition, there's no escape from culture. You know, these are the webs yeah. of significance in which we live, according to Gertz and Max Weber. But I mean, you think about it, and it becomes almost every man and every woman an artist. In that, you know, the Andy Warhol takes a movie camera and creates art. Chris Burden, you know, crucifies himself to an old Volkswagen and makes art. So in that sense, you are getting artists who are certainly aware of that kind of culture and doing their best to subvert it, I suppose.
Right, but it's almost like it's very difficult for them to be over against what they're critiquing, because there's so much in it. We're all in it.
Yeah, ain't that the truth?
And we can't escape it, which is, well, the whole idea of, you know, the artist or the intellectual, the alienated artist or intellectual who can stand uh-huh. outside and critique from the outside, I think they're a good example that really doesn't happen.
Well, I'm not. Maybe that's why we still have the system we have. Its power is immense. And the notion of being able to transcend it fully is impossible, just as much in the classroom as it is in the art world, or who knows, maybe even the Bernie Sanders campaign.
So because your book is a cultural critique, and I think it has so much present presence, how would you see this new sensibility expressed today? And I mean, I've been thinking about what you've said, and I'm seeing it everywhere. Something that was, I mean, we know it's there, but you actually named it for me. I wasn't aware of this new sensibility, and now I'm aware of it, and I have a name for it, that it had a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you see it expressed today?
Well, some might say that it has an end because we've gone so far and things have gotten so crazy that, you know, how much farther can you go? But I was thinking about this the other day. You know, it's a good question you bring up because David Bowie had passed. And I was never a huge David Bowie fan, but I started reading about Bowie. And I came upon an interview that he did with Vanity Fair magazine. And one of the, you know, they asked these open-ended questions. And one of them was something like, what is your favorite journey? And David Bowie responded, the road of artistic excess. And then somewhere else I saw David Bowie say that his ideal art would mix Schoenberg with Little Richard. And I'm thinking, man, oh man, here we're talking blurred genres in a big way. And then in 1999, he said something to the effect that I learned that mixing elements of bad taste and good taste oftentimes produce the most interesting results. And so in Bowie, I think you see exactly the same thing. And in many other artists today, you get this. What the new sensibility did is open up avenues to the outrageous and the outstanding. Now, sometimes those were confluent. Other times they just seemed outrageous and horrible. But in the best of all worlds, they came together. So with someone like Philip Glass, I think, you know, minimalism is brilliant. With someone like Madonna sometimes in her better moments, I think the maximalism was great. And so I think we still have John Waters, I think, is, you know, taking the camp sensibility, which is also central to the new sensibility. I think you have, you know, great art being done, or at least I like it.
In a more pedestrian, sort of ordinary expression of the new sensibility, I thought about things like reality TV, you know, social media where bullying and meanness have become standard values. Is there an anti-humanistic aspect to this?
That's a good question. You know, you can say that reality TV has its origins back in the early 70s. I think that was when An American Family debuted. I think I mentioned that in passing, you know, with the Loud family. So reality TV does have a long history. And I think you're absolutely right that such things as simple human conversation has been replaced by meanness, by going too far. It's over the edge. I think it's disgusting. Sometimes.
I mean, I'm thinking of things like The Bachelor and Springer Show and some of this, the stuff where people will say anything and do anything to win.
It's like in politics today, you think?
Well, I was going to get to that. I mean, is Donald Trump an example of a new kind of politician? He's not only a businessman and a capitalist, but he's also a product of reality TV. That's how he became a celebrity, and this is why he has so much play. People have seen him on reality TV. Mm-hmm. And so it's a new kind of politician. Is there ideology there? Who knows?
He's a performance artist extraordinaire.
Right.
Unfortunately, all of the performance is meant to boost his ego and to flim-flam, and that's what makes it, I think, outrageous and not outstanding, other than in terms of the pathetic success he's having. But there's a line that I from Roger Shattuck, who I think is a really fine writer and cultural critic, now passed. But Shattuck said something that when he wrote a book about censorship, he said something that for him, the key to great art is to have a balance, to reconcile liberation and limits. And I still think that there's truth to that. You know what I mean? I know that sometimes going too far can lead to wonderful work, and going too far can lead to terrible work. And I do think that nowadays in our popular culture, you know, it's as it has been, anything that sells is what's going to happen. And so I think, yes, reality TV, you can say, does have some of its origins in this kind of work. It may even have origins in Dada. It's not my cup of tea. And I can see it. You know, all movements give birth to various expressions. Some that seem more in keeping with the imperatives of the original movement, and some that are less so. And I suppose in that sense, that kind of multiplicity is as central to the legacy of the new sensibility as anything else. You know what I mean?
Right. So it's just a question that I had for you, because it seemed like there was an anti-humanistic strain throughout all this work.
Yeah, I think yes and no. I mean, you know, maybe the one thing is that it is obviously a rather capacious house, the New Sensibility. You know, and I'm trying to hold it together by excess. And you think of, you know, that in that house, humanism did exist. I think that, you know, Dylan and some of the others are trying to be humanistic. Styron, I think, in his way is trying to be humanistic. Arbus, in her way, is trying to do that as well. Erica Young is also. But I think at this point in time, the exuberance was, of course, anchored in breaking away from the polite, boring, you know, culture of what they saw as mainstream culture in the 1950s. And of course, culture is never absolutely singular. I mean, the New Sensibility, you know, coexists with what, you know, what were some of the big songs? I mean, for everything that you had that was New Sensibility, you had, the Carpenters were singing. I mean, I wouldn't put them in the New Sensibility, but they had number one hits. And sometimes I suppose one could be a fan of Jerry Lee Lewis or of the Grateful Dead and of the Carpenters, but in general, probably not.
So what is it about this New Sensibility that you would like, you want the reader to take away?
Well, I want them on the most simple level to say that maybe the New Sensibility is a good way of capturing a major stream in American culture that's origins can be seen in the early 50s with John Cage, reaching out and still existing today, and perhaps taking various roads, some of which you and I are less than thrilled with, but still having a common denominator. I want intellectual and cultural historians to be willing to cut across boundaries. I mean, I tried to deal with poets, with artists, with novelists, with filmmakers, with all different kind of performance artists. And I think one nice thing is to see how cultural change and cultural expressions occur and also permeate in so many different areas at approximately the same time. So what you see in Lenny Bruce's comedy is what you see in Ginsberg's poetry. It's what you see in Warhol's art. It's what you see in Dylan. I think that's important, that we cast our net as widely as possible. And then I wanted to illuminate, as I guess I haven't tried in most of my work, to show how the work influences the life. You can illuminate the life through the work, but also the work can be used to illuminate the life, or did I get that mixed up? The point is that it's a back and forth. I don't want to reduce life to work and work to life, but to show how these two things were working together. And then I guess the main thing is to produce a book that's accessible, that while I'm beholden to scholarship and, you know, in that famous phrase, I stand on the shoulders of giants, I also want it to be something that can be read for pleasure.
And well, it's very pleasurable to read. It's very well written. It's fascinating. It's like a movie.
All right, but a Warhol movie where it wanted to bore you after 8 hours?
No. Also, I think that there's something here that we could go further with the new sensibility. It's connection to, we've already kind of touched on it, economics but politics. Which you've already touched upon. And I think that there's probably a lot of exploration that could be done with this.
Yeah, I mean, politics is never far from this, because the politics of all these issues that they focused on are crucial. For example, violence. They're not celebrating violence, but they're bringing it to the forefront. I mean, who would ever have thought that Andy Warhol would be doing pictures of electric chairs. I mean, he was very much upset when Carol Chessman, who was a murderer, was finally executed. And so in that sense, you can see his art as being political. Lenny Bruce, for all of his use of dirty words, was not just braying against censorship, but was also taking stands on racial equality. Bob Dylan was, of course, taking stands. John Coltrane, in his work from 64-65, is also trying to capture this. Baraka, all of these Erica Jong's work, you know, is, of course, about sexual liberation, which is a personal level, but it's also about liberation. So, in a sense, what this work is about is the liberation of the self. And in order to liberate the self, I think all of these people would agree, getting back to your earlier point, that that requires a change in the social situation. The one where you see that the least, I suppose, is sometimes in figures like Denise Scott Brown and Robert Venturi. I mean, I don't know what their politics are. I assume they're progressive. But their work on Las Vegas is mostly concerned only with the form, with the style, you know. And so that seems to me to be the most surface, but it's very pluralistic. And they're saying, let's look at our society and see how all these different styles can somehow coexist and not rest comfortable with architecture has to be only one way. So in that degree, I think all of these figures are incredibly valuable for saying the way it's usually been done is not the only way. And oftentimes, you know, in any revolution, the first stage is to throw everything overboard, and that's what many of them are doing.
So I'm going to go back a little bit to something you said earlier in the book. You cast it within maybe the idea of the modernism, the early 20th century, and some of the critics of modernity. How does it also talk about that a little bit, and how does it relate to what we now consider postmodernism, which is, I know, a very complicated concept that nobody really knows what it means. So can you talk a little bit about that, their connection with...
More of us who don't quite know what it means. Well, let's just put it this way. Modernism was many different rivers flowing at the same time, and, of course, cutting across many different boundaries, rejecting Victorian certitude in many ways, making the artist into the sort of creator. I mean, you can come up with all these definitions, but there was definitely a movement that I think one can feel comfortable calling modernism. In an earlier book, when I was looking at American modernists, what I found was that they were reluctant modernists. That is, that for all of their acceptance of experimentalism in art, they still upheld certain bourgeois values, certain Victorian values, so that sometimes these shifts are not as absolute as we'd like to think they are. But of course, by the late 40s and early 50s, one can make the argument, and I guess even earlier in the 30s with the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, that modernism had become, if not calcified, at least it had become a kind of ism, a concept in which, rather than allowing things to grow, it seemed to make them into an almost kind of holy writ. And there you had critics like Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg, at least in terms of art, defining what constituted the modernist canon. You had museums supporting that, and of course you had collectors supporting that, and modernist art, as some have argued, at least in its move toward abstractionism, was quite easily serving the purposes of the Cold War by being exported abroad to show how free Americans were and stuff like that, though there was oftentimes people who didn't like the art and fought against it. But so I guess these figures, while you can see aspects of them in modernism, you can also see many of the aspects in terms of pluralism, in terms of postmodernism, because if postmodernism is about anything, it's about breaking away from master narratives. It's about plurality. It's about blurring lines between genres, between high and low culture. So I suppose that many of these figures would be comfortable in postmodernism. However, most of them, it seems to me, are not about effacing the self. You know, you talked earlier about their subjectivity, and I think, don't hold me to this, but I think that most postmodernists tend not to dwell on the subjectivity of the artist. So yes, there's a relation, but it's not an exact one.
Okay. That's great. So, George, what are you working on now?
Well, I was thinking about returning to my novel, but I've decided that I would like to write a book that is more of a traditional narrative, with a narrative arc, with excitement, with figures that come together and that captures an era. So I think I'm going to write a book about Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney. I know that's a that's a break, but I think it'll be called Luck, Pluck, and Thrills, Jack Dempsey, Gene Tunney, and the 1920s.
So are you going to do it this in the genre of the New Sensibility?
I'll get back to you on that. I don't know. I mean, I'm just starting to research it. I was when I was much younger a boxing fan, and then I moved away from it because of the violence and I didn't approve of it. But for some reason, I've just become entranced with Dempsey, Tunney, and their personalities and how in some ways they define the 1920s, perhaps more than Fitzgerald and Hemingway do. And I'd like to use them as a conduit to understanding the period and to understanding their lives and what they meant to America.
Okay.
I could change next week, but that's it right now.
Well, thank you, George. You've written a fascinating book. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.